Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, and my co-host is Adam Wybrow. We're joined today by my boyfriend, Matty.
Hello.
And we're talking about The Black Cauldron, which is the first PG-rated Disney film from 1985. A full transcript will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy.
Good evening, Ren, and happy Halloween.
Oh, yes, it's going to be a Halloween episode, isn't it?
Let's be realistic, it's probably going to be a Halloween episode.
Yeah.
I've already brought a great Halloween decoration from TK Maxx. Yeah.
Of Halloween decorations.
I know, they come in so early, so I'm glad I managed to snatch one up. It's a skeleton toad, but the toad skeleton has warts. So it's like the bones of the toad have warts.
Okay, I need to introduce our guest, Matty, so that he can react.
Your toad has bone spurs.
Exactly.
Your toad cannot serve in the military. But yes, hello, I'm Matty and I'm here.
Matty is here in the same existing zone as me, sitting at the same countertop.
Yeah, about 2 foot away.
Yeah. new experiments in podcast recording.
Yeah, I know.
I've never...
I'm existing in the same.
Yeah,
in the same zone as a broken shoulder. My broken shoulder. That would sound quite sinister.
To give Adam lots of sympathy.
Thanks.
I came off my bike I feel guilty about, because I'm having the week off teaching and I feel really guilty about it, but I know my students are going to be like, yeah, cover teachers, we can run riot, destroy the room. So I really shouldn't feel guilty. They'll be having a whale of a time. In fact, one of the cover teachers did message me saying one of the classes was really misbehaving. So on tomorrow's cover lesson, I put on a slide saying, look, your Peppa Pig and Paw Patrol stickers have arrived. You won't be getting them if you treat the cover teachers badly. Personally, I don't know, I didn't think they'd go for those, but they put in their requests for stickers, and I guess it's kind of nostalgic for that generation of teenagers. So.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful.
But nonetheless, yeah. I did manage to watch this week's film and play this week's game, The Black Cauldron.
Legend has it, there was once a king so cruel and so evil that the gods feared him. Since no prison could hold him, he was trapped forever in the form of a great black cauldron.
The old king, that black-hearted devil.
Walt Disney Pictures presents The Black Cauldron. Escape into a world of darkness.
Are you coming?
Me? Go in there? Oh, no. It's a terrible place.
A world of excitement. A world of dreams.
Aaron, the great
greatest warrior, a true hero.
And through the magic of 70mm photography and 6-track Dolby sound, you will be transported to a fantasy event for the entire family.
Look! Look, sire! It's working!
Soon, the Black Cauldron will be mine.
In the great tradition of Disney animated classics, now comes the newest Disney spectacle of them all, the Black Cauldron.
Yeah, Adam, despite being injured, has gone above and beyond and also played a game for this.
Yeah.
I have not. I've just watched a film.
You mean you didn't play an ancient Sierra adventure game with punishing deaths and almost no way to complete it without a walkthrough?
I didn't.
Broadening the horizons of the podcast.
Well, I will say that to play this, I had to blue tack down my function key because in a exciting innovation, this Sierra game doesn't actually work via text prompts. Like, you don't get to type in the instructions. It works via the function keys, those keys that normally control your volume and do other things. So because it's quite a strain, especially if a broken shoulder, to stretch your way across the function key of your little finger to touch all the other keys to interact, I blue tacked it down. But I will say that I only lasted 10 minutes in the game, I'll go back to the game because it is a faithful adaptation, but I played the equivalent of the first 20 minutes of the film.
Okay.
Do you get the impression that it is just playing along the film, where if you make choices that diverge from the plot of the film, you die?
Well, I died of dehydration and not drinking enough water, and I didn't see much water consumption in the film. So I feel like there was a hard survivalist element to the game that maybe wasn't present in the film.
Simulationist Black Cauldron game.
Yeah, exactly. And also the goose was far more aggressive in the film. The geese are quite scared, actually. Whereas
those are some unrealistic geese.
To be fair, actually, Ren and I have both lived on York campus, and to be fair, they are unrealistically fearful geese. So I will say that the game, the Sierra game, does a much better job at simulating geese. Because there was a goose that just kept knocking me down over and over again.
I mean, that must have been, when we did live in York, Adam would get particularly picked on by the geese for some reason.
I'm glad you recognised that. It's just like my dad gets picked on by chickens, I think, in the family.
They really went for you.
Yeah, it's true.
And
I don't even eat them.
You don't even eat them.
Yeah, but do they know that?
This is the Black Cauldron from 1985. It's a Disney film. It did not do very well upon release.
I think it managed to earn back about half of its production budget.
And was constantly banished to limbo for quite some time.
Yeah, it's not even like an offensive one. It's not like Song of the South, which, you know, is rightfully banished because it's horrendously offensive and racist. Like, this was just banished because it didn't make Disney enough money.
In
Disney's eyes, the greater sin, let's be honest.
Well, I mean, they were still advertising Song of the South on videos that I had as a kid in the 90s. So,
Well, you didn't hear anything about the Black Cauldron. I don't think I heard of it as a kid.
No.
See, this is where I reckon that Black Cauldron is to Disney what Earthsea is to Studio Ghibli. I think it, like, they wanted it to be something, and then too many cooks made it not a good film, and they had to just mind hole it.
Well, I still get quite cross about Earthsea, because the glorious Ursula Le Guin was lied to. Ghibli told her that that Miyazaki would direct it. Now, she obviously, she didn't think, oh, that means his not very good son. Yeah. And that's just like a bait and switch. She can't do yeah. that.
Yeah.
And, like, this is a much lighter version of that situation, in as far as, like, when asked about it, Lloyd Alexander, who wrote the books, basically said, like, it's a great film. Like, I had a lovely time watching it as a film. Very different from the books. Hope yeah. you read the books. But, yeah, it's fine. It's fun.
Yeah. That's...
Yeah, like, we'll take that.
Wasn't bitterly disappointed. Like
that. Yeah, profoundly offended.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, so had... you'd seen it before this, Ben.
Loved it as a kid.
Okay. Yeah. I had not seen it until 2 days ago.
Yeah, I watched it for the first time ever today.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. What did? What were your feelings about it as a kid, Matthew?
I mean, watching it yesterday for the first time since I was about 7, I was struck by the fact that I remembered nothing about any of the interpersonal relationships whatsoever, and mostly just remembered how cool the Horned King was, and like that pig was just having the time of her life. There was a whole bunch of interactions. I was like, I don't remember this. What's this romance situation? Who's this dude? What's going on? So presumably, as is classic, like little kid Matthew was just like, that Horned King's awesome. Look at all these corpses coming out of this cauldron. This is a great time. I want to watch that again.
Yeah. I mean, my understanding is that the final cut was quite censored, that a fair amount of footage was cut out.
Yeah, there's about... From what I was... I had a 4-hour train journey today, so there's been research. From what I can gather, 12 minutes was cut out. On the 25th anniversary DVD, 8 minutes of that cut footage is on there as bonus. Oh. What we didn't find out is if the version on Disney Plus, which it is, I'm presuming it's the version that was released. Because yeah, you're watching it and it's just like things will, someone will say something and then it will never be referred to again. You're like, ah, I see cuts.
I don't understand Disney Plus though, if it sends shit, because like they get rid of the Simpsons joke, that's not a knife, that's a spoon. I see you've played Knifey Spoony before then. That's not
I didn't know that.
But yeah, that's completely cut. But God. The whole Cartridge Family episode where Homer gets a gun and just shoots up the house for the whole episode, that's fine.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, well.
I don't know.
Wow.
And obviously all of American Horror Story is on there too, which... It's not just queasy and often unpleasant, but, you know, quite aggressively problematic in its cheerful kind of way. So, heaven
knows. So, the setup for the Black Cauldron, we watched the intro again just before this to get clear, because it goes by quite fast, that there is some kind of ancient evil king, in order to... depose him, he's thrown alive into molten iron, at which he becomes a cauldron, which is the Black Cauldron, which can then be used to bring forth the deathless army of the undead at a future date.
Okay, so the king is the cauldron.
I believe so, yes.
Rather than... Because I thought the spirit of the king had been trapped in the cauldron, but that now explains why the cauldron has a face.
Yeah, no, I think he is meant to be the cauldron. That's the impression I got, anyway.
I do also quite like how... There's a few scenes later on where the climax of the film is occurring, and just the cauldron's face looks so judgmental.
That's not cooking a hot pot.
Yeah, they don't evil king like they used to in my day.
And I haven't written much of a summary of this, so it might be a little bit erratic.
Well, Matty watched begins... as a kid, so Matty knows this plot inside out by the sounds of it.
So we have a boy, Taron, who's like the twin brother of the kid, Arthur, I guess, from The Sword and the Stone. Very, very similar.
Yeah, same actor.
Yeah, same actor. He's an assistant pig keeper. He quite quickly gets, I've written The Child Craves War. This is my first note. He wants to be a soldier. There's a war going on and he wants to be involved.
Yeah, he wants to kill.
Yeah. His mentor person is like, no, you need to look after the pig. Yeah. She's a very important pig.
He's really jealous of the magic pig.
He's also...
like, a lot of his anger is coming from, like, the preferential treatment given to the pig.
Yeah. So he's giving the pig her bath. Henwyn.
What's her name? I've completely forgotten the pig's name. Like
Henwyn.
Penguin?
Henwyn.
Oh, Henwyn. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
And she starts squealing and, being frightened, and they realise that the pig can see visions, and they see that the Horned King is searching. The Horned King's searching for the pig so that he can find the cauldron, right?
I think the Horned King is searching for the cauldron, but is aware of the pig as a route to finding the cauldron.
Yeah. Okay. Right, yeah.
I mean, how do you discover that you have an oracular pig? Like, how does it let itself... You know, is this a sort of... The pig has been traded as a piglet. Like, oh, yeah, well, I've got this special oracular pig, and it's got sightseeing abilities. Or is it more that there are some kind of weird coincidences... or something, like the pig, like,
yeah,
makes a sort of scuff mark in the dirt that looks like an acorn, and then suddenly you go into the field and there's a load of acorns. Does this pig come from a long line of pig oracles? Like,
I mean, the method of drawing the visions out of the pig is to get her to look at some water and then kind of swirl it and say an incantation. So I do wonder if just at some point pig was stood next to a pond and there were duck swims by, and then the pond is full of visions of the future, and they're like, ah,
yeah,
that would be an oracular pig.
Yeah,
you got there. Yeah,
I mean, it might, I don't know about the incantations though, they might just be in an almanac or something, like, sort of medieval almanac of, if you happen to have an oracular, they might pig, even... this is what you should say, you know.
I like the idea that they're not necessary, they're just a bit of razzle dazzle.
yeah
maybe that's a fair point.
so the horned king is has this flowing purple cloak and these curling horns. He wants the black cauldron to raise this army of deathless warriors. He is thirsting to be a god among mortal men. So Taron, the boy, has to take the pig and go. So
just go sit in the woods with the pig.
Just
his mentor will come and get him at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just be away. So
I thought he was taking the pig to the fey folk because they're invisible and could invisible the pig.
Is that what he's doing?
I thought so. I thought... He says goodbye to his mentor. So I think he's being sent on a journey give the pig, you know, in safekeeping to the fairy. I think it's because he fails really quickly.
He really does. he goes to hide in the woods where he has lived his entire life, his whole life in these woods, and within the distance it takes for a pig to run away, there's just this like giant ominous castle that apparently no one knew about.
Yeah,
I mean, that's about as far as I got in the game, admittedly. I did the first I mean, I wouldn't call it a puzzle. It's more of a task. So I fed the pig some gruel. And then the pig follows you and runs into the cottage. And then you get the kind of divination. And then you're told to lead the pig to the fairy folk. And then one of those sort of giant pterodactyl creatures swoops down and takes you and the pig. You get thrown to the ground. And then I just kept being told, you're really thirsty. You need some water. And I was surrounded by water. I went to the river, pressed the use button. There's nothing to use here. Went to the water trough the pig drinks from. Nothing to use here. And then I died of dehydration. And then being a serial gamer then lectured me about how you should really be more careful and make sure that your character drinks water. And I thought, I'm too old to be lectured by a Sierra gamer, so...
Yeah, not having this.
Not having this.
Fair, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you meet a Gurgi in the game?
Yes. And I didn't have anything to give him, so he just sort of pranced in. So he's a little kind of beast man. He's a prances in and then... asked for some food and I didn't have any and then pranced away again, basically. But that was the best part of the game.
Yeah, because Taron, in between losing the pig and the pig being taken away by dragons, meets the hairy little creature who steals his apple has a little Gollum voice.
It's kind of like a cross between Gollum and a Fizzgig.
Yes. Does anyone want to do the munchings and crunchings?
Munchity crunchity. Oh.
Munchings and crunchings in there somewhere. He's trying to steal the apple.
Yeah, Gurgi has no friends, but Gurgi wants friends.
Mm.
To steal food from them.
Yeah. So Henwin's taken away and Taron's like, oh, well, I need to go to the castle to get my pig back. And Gurgi's like,
you will absolutely die. I'm not getting involved in this.
The rather desolate vision of Gurgi on the sort of the cliff top edge. As I was saying, I will never see my friend again, or something.
Yeah, it's so sad. Like, he's not wrong. Like, do not go to that castle.
Oh, no, by all rights, he should die very early. Like I did in the game. The game is a far more realistic, to be fair. Not just from lack of water, but like, yeah, there are a lot of close scrapes in this film.
Yeah, there's definitely peril.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot. I don't even think it's mild peril. I think it's considerable. No.
Moderate to severe peril, I'd say. Yeah. In the castle, poor little Henwen is in shackles. It's very sad.
It's very tragic.
Yeah.
Like, the worst party imaginable is having.
Yeah, there's goblins, I thought it was a two-headed dragon. I think it's actually just two dragons sitting next to each other, which is less exciting. Yeah. There's a fat dancing lady of the kind that Disney enjoys animating.
She's having a blast.
Yeah, so I will make that claim.
There's really good flags.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like all the drapery in this terrible party is really good.
Yeah.
And everyone at the party is the worst.
I think actually there's a real difference in quality in this film between the backgrounds and the character animation.
Because
there is some astonishing background work and some pretty shonky character animation.
Yep.
The backgrounds are beautiful.
Yeah, the backgrounds are like, it's funny because there are times where the game, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just walking from screen to screen. I was like, it's like a walking simulator. But actually, with the film, I probably would be happy to just like look at it. Just have no action. You know, there's not much of a storyline. So, it's, just, you know, go full slow cinema. Just you know, just have.
Shall we do texture of the week?
Okay. Let's do it. Medieval right. chanting, maybe. Extra of the week, extra of the week, of the week.
Lovely, thank you. Because mine was the mossy, craggy interior.
Oh, come on! We keep having the same textures, Ray.
No, we've been doing this too long.
We keep doing this. It's quite. I'm starting to find it was cute at first. Now I'm starting to find it a bit odd. It's starting to freak me a bit.
I think mine was the delight of that pig having a bath.
Just
the like soft pig skin and the bubbles and the scrubby brush.
That's
nice. Like this. That was just a really good pig bath.
I did also really like the skeleton of the former bard. That was just really nicely painted. It was just one of the really nice backgrounds.
Yeah. No, there's some gorgeous backgrounds in this. I wrote moss and lichen.
Yeah. these are these kind of blue greys and kind of orange browns. Like, it's really, really good backgrounds.
The red of the sky around the Horn King's castle was very, like, if you've ever seen, like, a sunset somewhere with a lot of air pollution... Like it was really well done. I'm just like, yeah, no, that's a bad place to be breathing. Do not be there.
So in this castle, in this bad vibes party, Henwin refuses to show the Horned King where the Black Cauldron is. She's threatened. I couldn't quite tell if the Horned King's henchmen were like orcs or if they were just bestial humans.
Yeah, like, I mean, they definitely seemed like beings you would encounter in a fighting fantasy game book. That's what I felt. But there's a kind of slightly generic dark fantasy vibe, and I know that this was an attempt to appeal to a more teenage audience. And I do wonder if this was trying to ride the D&D coattails a bit, actually.
Right in the middle of the satanic panic.
Yeah.
Which probably didn't help at the pictures.
there were probably too many parents who were like, oh, no, you're not going to see... I don't know why they're... They could be suffering. You're not going to see that.
It's called devil in it.
Yeah.
This is John Hurt, who plays the Horned King with some relish. And when Taran falls out of his hiding place, he says, "Boy, are you the keeper of this oracular pig?" which is very enjoyable.
It's quite a good John Hurt impression.
No, thank you. Taran's like, no, she's not going to tell you where this cauldron is. But then they get the guillotine out, and he's like, all right, Henwin, tell him. But they kind of, I think there's some sort of commotion happens, and he sort of runs away with the pig. I've lost the timeline a little bit because there's the bard in the...
There's a chase scene through the castle.
So we're in the dungeon, right?
Oh yeah.
And then we get our two other characters then for our plucky trio are then introduced.
I think before the dungeon we've got to punt Henwin into the moat.
Yeah.
for a fall that would absolutely kill a pig. Like, if you hit water at that speed, it's like hitting concrete at that height even. But she's a magic pig and it's fine.
It's just a little airborne. It's still good. It's still good.
Yeah, it's good. It's fine. It's fine. Water's soft. Yeah, because he gets the pig away and then is caught and goes to the dungeon.
And in the dungeon there is a bard who has a Welsh name that is not pronounced Welshly.
Okay, so how should it be pronounced?
Okay, if you were pronouncing this Welshly, Matty,
Flodhir Flam.
But they pronounce it.
It's not quite Floody Flum, but it's not far off.
Yeah, because you were telling me a bit about the author and like the background of.
Oh yeah, so this is like kind of Welsh flavored several times removed, because the author of it is a American called Lloyd Chudley Alexander, who writes as Lloyd Alexander. And he was in the US Army during World War II, and wasn't in any combat roles because he could not combat roll so good. So he was a cymbal player in a marching band for a while and a chaplain's assistant. And he was stationed in England and Wales for like a few months, as far as I can gather, and just got really into Welsh folklore and the Mabinogion. Oh. And then used a lot of that as the background for the books. But it's quite like... it's flavour. And then that going through the Disney machine and then going through voice actors that don't know Welsh is beautiful. I love it. I am personally delighted to see my culture just get mangled, because it's really funny. And like, it's nice that people know we're there.
So there's a bard who
has a harp that a string on it breaks any time that he lies, which is like implied and never really gone into.
Oh yeah.
Also, he's a king of his own kingdom, which they also don't really go into. Yeah, it's like mentioned in passing at some point and then never touched on again.
Right. And the other member of our trio is Princess Alonwi. Who sort of just wanders into the attic.
I found that really cool.
Taran's being kept.
Okay, is she like mid escape herself, right?
I think so, yeah. Well, yeah, she does seem to have a lot of free rein for a prisoner, but I don't.
Yeah, you don't really get much of a sense of if she's like in the process of escaping, or if she's just like, I'm just gonna live in the walls and do people's hair. This is fun.
But she was captured because she has like a moat, a kind of floating bauble thing. Like, it's very similar to what Link has.
Yes, yeah, she's got Navi, isn't she? Yeah. I wrote in my notes, hey Navi.
And the Horned King captured her because he thought that her bauble could tell him where the Black Cauldron is.
I quite like the idea that the Horned King is just like going through like the local kind of random divination objects locally, just like, oh okay, well okay, this person has a tarot deck, we'll get them in. And they've got a special shaped stick, yeah, have them in the dungeon, we'll see if that works.
I also like the idea that the Horned King's got the equivalent of like when someone loses their hamster and like the hamster just lives in the walls, but it's a child. It's just like someone let her escape and now like we can hear her, but we don't quite know where she is.
but she leads Taran to escape, and on the way he finds a glowing sword, which is quite handy.
It's a bit too handy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically a plasma cutter, isn't it?
Yeah, huh? Yeah, like, it's like the equivalent of playing a video game with a game genie, basically.
Yeah.
they have a little fight and a chase across a drawbridge, and they run away. And
but like,
then,
well, and okay, get... what's really cool about the sword, and this is cool, but also it kind of removes any heroism at all, is like the sword isn't just powerful, it knows what to do. So the sword, for instance, cuts the rope of the drawbridge.
Oh, yeah.
But he doesn't think to do that. So the sword always attacks the most useful thing to attack. So it's like the sword has some kind of like intelligence, maybe, or is just so lucky that it kind of bends space-time and, yeah, always ends up at the... I don't know, I quite like that idea. It's not really gone into. It's not explained, but the idea that it's not just a powerful sword, it's like a sword that kind of... It's like a cheat code. It's like the sword that always lets you win, somehow.
Yeah. It's sort of imagining the intelligence of a magical weapon that's just been stuck in a basement for a long time, just like, you'll do. Like, just get me out of here till someone better can find me.
I did get a similar sense watching this film, not to the same extent as The Mouse and His Child, but a bit of a, like, this would make more sense if I read the book. Like, I mean...
Yeah, and this is... Matthew, like... This is two... this is two...
No, okay. Matthew's shaking his head.
This is two books of five. And, like, the Horned King is a very minor character.
Oh,
so it's sort of like a mushing together of bits of the story, to make a good film.
Okay.
Like, I've not read these books since I was about 13, so I can't really help
you. So the Horned King is just this guy, you know?
Like, he's just this guy. He's just a little guy. Just a weird little guy. And I don't remember very much about the books. I was gonna try and read them, and then I realized that I knew about doing this 2 days ago, and that was stupid. But I'm not sure the books would help.
Fair. Okay,
but I don't think my main enjoyment, I mean, you said, Matty, that your memory of the film isn't primarily plot based, and I do think the plot is just sort of one thing after another. The plotting and, you know, the characters aren't that memorable, but it has a certain something. Like, I can see why it didn't do very well, but at the same time, I don't know, it does have quite a lot of peril, and I do think it has a certain atmosphere, and some of those backgrounds are gorgeous.
It's beautiful. Yeah. It barrels along really well, and certainly as an adult who has been diagnosed with ADHD, I can entirely imagine my child self just completely phasing out the conversation to look at the background, and then getting barreled along with the action as it happens. And like, you don't really need to know what's going on, because it's a good film, but not in the ways that films are meant to be good.
Yes, yeah.
There's some amazing set pieces, the Horned King is so captivating, and like must have been so scary. We have a friend, Hal, who
he may have been taken to the pictures to see it, and he may have been hiding because it was not a good time. And the thing with it, like with the footage that was cut. So, like, this film was sort of made in the armpit between classic Disney and Disney Resurgence.
Yeah, yeah.
Which meant that there was just a lot of people... Old guard had left, new guard hadn't quite settled in yet, so there's just all this turmoil in the studio.
Yeah, and this directed by the same people as Fox and the Hound, isn't it?
Yeah. And, like, basically, all of the edits of the footage that was taken out was after it had finished being animated, so, like, all the work had been done. Usually you'd sort of cut things about while it's still in storyboard. And part of it was because when they tested it, people were too scared. it was previously more frightening. And they were like, no, you need to cut a bunch of this. I think there was like more with the army. I'm really curious about this because as a story, there's no world building. Like the only people that we know exist are... Like Taran, the fair folk, and the people. So, who is the Horned King going to kill? what is he conquering? And like, I don't know if maybe some of that cut footage was people getting absolutely ganked by a lot of skeletons.
Just
a
Ray Harryhausen skeleton war.
Yeah.
Oh, I want the horror cut.
Yeah, I. I do wish it, because it is still pretty dark, but I did kind of feel like, ah, it could lean into it even more. And I looked up, of course, Tim Burton's original character designs, which are really charming as well, which Disney rejected.
Oh, that was this one, right.
Yeah, Burton did a bunch of character designs, which are, as you'd imagine them, like, you could, you know, sharp teeth, ridiculous sort of body proportions, scraggly hair. Just as you'd imagine, basically. But yeah, that would have been fun.
Oh, it would have been brilliant. And there's a whole soundtrack done for it. The name of the composer slips my mind, but it's sort of like, oh, that's quite a big name. It might have been Elmer Bernstein. But because of the cuts they made, none of the soundtrack lined up anymore, so they just had to cobble something else together. So there's clearly, like, an amazing film that clearly happened.
Yeah, no, I agree. I do feel it's one of those kind of Death by a Thousand Cut films, that it's a film that's been somewhat butchered in production, but you can see what's great there.
Oh, and there was an animator strike halfway through. Which obviously, like absolutely support strikers, and also that can have an interesting effect on production.
Yeah.
Sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. But like, so we don't really know how that impacted this.
Yeah, so after the boy and the princess and the bard escape, Gergi turns up again and points out tracks that could be Henwin's, which they follow to a pink and purple whirlpool that they fall in, and then there's these little cutesy baby fairies this is the Fae folk. They're not all like little babies. Some of them have beards, but. They live under this whirlpool. One of them asks, "Is the burning and the killing still going on up there?" I guess I'm not actually sure what burning and killing.
I think I thought that was just humans being humans, and like, humans still do humans. We're still.
I also quite like that we know the Fae folk are magical Fae folk because they're the only American accents in the whole film, which I found really sweet.
I didn't notice that. That's funny.
They glow very nicely. I don't know if that's where there's a little bit of. It's apparently the first animated Disney film to use some CGI. I assumed that was with the kind of elemental effects. And there's a cloud. There's a really odd sort of cloud. It looks really composite, the shot early on, where you get these sort of strange clouds in the background, which I think are CGI. And I did wonder if the glowing was done with CGI in this, because I always assumed that the glowing in Fantasia must have taken a ridiculous amount of time. Like, if you think about the fairies in Fantasia, that always looks so labour intensive.
There is, later on, around the cauldron, when it gets green and bubbly, the smoke on that, they matted in dry ice. Which, again, so much effort. It looks really good, and if you, like, you wouldn't notice. There's no reason why you'd notice, but it's so cool.
there's some really great compositing, actually, in this film.
So the fairies say that the Black Cauldron is hidden in Morva, in the marshes of Morva. So they go there and they find some swamp witches in a cave of frogs. both me and Matty made the note of a sort of quite overly long shot of the bard being turned into a frog and bouncing in one of the witch's cleavage.
I did think old texture of the week, and then I thought, no, I'm not. That's not becoming.
Would you like a Welsh language fact?
Yes.
Morva is a fen or a salt marsh. So the marshes of Morva is the marshes of salt marsh.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks.
Welsh facts.
it could be a recurring segment.
Well, I mean, we'll have to get you back on for if we do Diana Wynne Jones and like.
We should do more Diana Wynne Jones, actually.
Like, yeah, you know, House Moving Castle,
Champion.
Yeah. The book of which is much significantly more Welsh than the Studio Ghibli film, unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
They ask the witches about this black cauldron, and they say the witches will say that they'll trade the magic sword for the cauldron. So, and they're like, wahaha, we'll get the sword, and then they won't be able to use the cauldron, so we'll get the cauldron as well. And,
I don't really get the logic there. Do they just think that they'd just be like, oh, we can't do anything with this cauldron, have it back?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So Taran gives up the sword. They get the black cauldron and they learn that it requires a sacrifice. Like, someone has to be consumed by the cauldron to stop it.
And specifically, they have to go into it willingly. You can't just punt someone into it.
Yeah,
jobs are good, and like they've got to be doing it for that purpose.
Yeah, because it seems like if you put unwilling sacrifices into the cauldron, it creates more evil power. And then,
yeah, the cauldron would be pretty into that.
Yeah, yeah, but then if you're a willing sacrifice, the cauldron doesn't like it, and that takes away the power. So I did wonder if at the end of the film there's going to be a back and forth. You know, like a character willingly sacrificed themselves, and then like the demon. You know, the Horned King throws someone else, and then someone else has to sacrifice themselves, and it's just this awful tit for tat. You know, when will they learn, kind of thing. That didn't happen, but I did wonder. For, I was like, oh, yeah, I wonder if it's going to be some kind of horrible balancing act.
Mm. Yeah, or like that one hand on the other hand slapping game that you play with little kids. But with dead people.
And also, like, I probably overthought this, but I was like, what about if, like, you willingly sacrifice yourself to the cauldron, but you change your mind, like, half a second before hitting the water? Like, does that not count? Like...
You have, like, buyer's remorse.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You're like, oh, no, I don't actually... And then the cauldron's like, ah-ha-ha, I do like it now.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Yeah, no, I was trying to really work out the metaphysics of this. And remember, the cauldron is like an evil king with, yeah, that's become a cauldron with a face. So presumably he makes his own rules, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess he knows what he's into. He knows what he likes the taste of. So it's like, you know. Does it mean that the more scared you are, the tastier you are, or is it like because I don't know, it's all very confusing. Like because like the Demon King, right? The Horned King. I mean, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I think this is an important metaphysical point. The Horned King does not want to go into that cauldron, right? The Horned King is a very unwilling sacrifice. But the Black Cauldron likes unwilling sacrifices. So surely, by that logic, the Horned King going into the cauldron should give the cauldron more evil power and should bring the skeletons back to life.
I guess... I wonder... I guess it's kind of a question of whether these magical objects in this world have an... Like, is the magic an intelligence? Like, that sword... I like the cauldron, because if that cauldron is basically the last vestiges of the consciousness of an incredibly evil king has just been being dug out of a hole periodically by whoever wants to currently be an evil king, do you think at some point you're just like, actually, can I just die? Like, I'm done. I have seen every mediocre Johnny-come-lately villain for, like, eons uncounted, and I'm just done. I don't want to do this anymore. Give me the little fluffy guy, it's fine.
and to be fair, while the cauldron has a kind of, you know, a frozen evil face, you know, maybe that's not the actual face anymore. Maybe, you know, maybe he's changed, you know. It's been a long time.
The cauldron's done the 12 steps. Moving away from eating people.
I mean, it might be a Manny Rat situation all over again, you know? Yeah, I think that is my main thing with this film. I want to know more about this cauldron, because the title is The Black Cauldron, and the fact that this cauldron is a king. I don't know. I need to know more about what's going on with this cauldron.
Yeah, because we have a whole like section that Ren quite rightly skipped over, presumably because you forgot about the romance argument making up section in the woods.
Oh, God, yeah.
We didn't need that. I want, like you, Adam, I want more cauldrons.
The cauldron's the good stuff.
Like, on some level, I do kind of really like the way cauldron, that little... Right? It's a big lad.
Yeah, it makes for some great... There's this great composition, right, where they've been gifted the cauldron by the witches, and it's our little trio sat round the fire with the cauldron in the background, like, just looming large, and they don't know what to do with it. And they just sat there looking quite morose around the fire with this giant cauldron, being like, what? Well, we've got it, but... Yeah.
Yeah, and the fairy that brought them there just being like, you're a bunch of idiots, I'm going home. This is why I don't deal with people. Goodbye. So, fair.
Yeah, and they are quite swiftly captured. And the strung up in the dungeon, and the Horned King really goes to town with the cauldron. And he's got his hood back now, and you can see his skull face.
Yeah, it's gone full Skeletor.
Yeah. And there was a great bit of animation where he lowers this skeleton into the cauldron to reanimate the army of death. And as the skeletons are kind of reanimating, there's a kind of, I don't really know what the effect is. It's a kind of looks like a double exposure kind of thing. They're sort of it's kind of blurry.
I thought, because it does look like double exposure, and I was trying to work out how you would do that with animation and whether it is something that's been done with the film itself.
It's very cool.
It's really cool. Yeah. No, some of this is a bit like the kind of end of Fantasia, actually, in terms of kind of just doing interesting things with skeletons and demonic beings. Like,
I don't think I ever got to the end of Fantasia. I think I just like watch the broom bit, and then I'm like, oh, I'm good.
I'm done. Yeah, no, I really slogged. I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, but I thought that Fantasia was basically edifying, and that it was my moral responsibility as a young child to watch this very educational film. So even though I didn't like large bits of it, I still forced myself to watch it anyway.
Oh, yeah, no, I feel like I can relate to that. Not necessarily specifically Fantasia, but I feel like child you and child me had some similar, like at some point we hit puberty and like, wait, I don't have to do that.
Yeah.
Why did I do that?
Yeah, like a lot of the kind of, like, you know, I still have a real fondness for sort of educational video games, but honestly, a lot of why I played, like, you know, Mavis Beacon's Teacher Typing and stuff was because I thought it was a kind of morally good thing to do. Like, oh, I'm not playing, you know, silly video games. I'm playing educational games.
And I've started, so I've got to finish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But one of the lines I've highlighted here is from The Bard. I really liked, so when obviously there's this raising of all the skeletons and everything's looking really bleak, he says, I wish I'd stayed a toad.
Yes.
Bouncing and some cleavage.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that was one of the perks for him, potentially, but
yeah.
I just mean that, like, you know, I don't know, I get that. Like, wait, just life, right? And having to live and have consciousness. And I do think, you know, it would be a bit nice just being a toad, probably.
Well, presumably we have found the inspiration for the corner shop hit Brimful of Asher. Like, this is the original bosom pillow. It was a toad all along.
Yeah.
There is also a very good skull made of lava that comes out. It's really cool.
Nice mention. Good mention. Thank you for mentioning that. Yes. It was really good.
I was wondering if this was... I don't know how far Hal got through this film, but maybe not this far.
I should have asked him.
Yeah.
I also should have checked if we can, like, absolutely... I wasn't going to say out, but I also didn't tell you not to.
It hasn't had lasting repercussions, has it?
Nah, he's all right. Yeah, he's all right. He just doesn't want to watch Black Cauldron. It's quite simple for him.
I mean, God, you know, I hid in the toilet of the cinema during that bit in Empire Strikes Back when R2-D2 gets swallowed by that kind of snaky sandworm thing on the planet.
Oh,
darling, that's fair.
I went out and just hid in the toilet for like 5-10 minutes until I was sure that bit had passed. Hunchback of Notre Dame, I think I lasted about 5 minutes full stop.
Fair.
I was out of that cinema.
Disney Plus, like, after I'd finished Black Cauldron, it like came up with Hercules, and that was one that really got me.
Oh, that's interesting.
There's an animation where I think someone goes into the underworld.
Yeah.
And I found it really, really disturbing.
Oh, grabby dudes.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I vaguely remember. I've only seen it like once at some university event. But I vaguely remember what you mean.
Yeah, Bambi got me. Yeah, the mum getting shot.
Really? Yeah, I don't think it... I quite liked Bambi, I vaguely remember. I remember finding that a bit scary and sad, but not to the degree I would have imagined. My mum got really upset. She said, as a kid, seeing Pinocchio in the cinema. Which is fair, because I think that we should probably do... You know, I mean, okay, it's not really children's horror, but the whole donkey sequence and the whale sequence are both just remarkably horrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a bit when they're all tied up and the Horned King is doing his villain monologue where he's like, oh, it's the pig keeper and the slightly rubbish bard. And he calls Elonwy a scullery maid.
Yes.
Which... is never mentioned before, and is never mentioned because she says she's a princess.
Yeah,
he says she's a scullery maid. At no point is she like, "Oh, I'm so embarrassed to be called a scullery maid," or he just says it.
I thought that was really interesting. I wonder if it's that she's like, "Well, you know, I'm princess. I'm keeping to it. I'm not gonna, you know, if my friends aren't gonna mention it, I'm not gonna mention it."
Yeah, perfect. Like, that is spot on.
So, Gergi jumps into the cauldron in this sequence that's I don't know, it's very visually reminiscent of the end of Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
Gollum falling into Mount Doom. But Gergi goes willingly, unlike Gollum.
He sort of turns up, releases his friends as this army is marching to go murder apparently no one. He's like, I'll stop it.
And you said that Andy Serkis said that Gergi is an influence.
Oh, what?
Apparently so.
Oh, wow.
That weird little guy. This film overlaps with so many different things.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
So Gergi jumps in, and then the cauldron's still active.
Yeah, like the armies all fall down.
Yeah.
The king is cross.
But the cauldron demands more.
Feed me, Seymour!
Yeah. The Horned King is kind of torn to shreds as the cauldron sucks him in.
Oh, that's pretty gruesome, actually.
It's quite nasty. Yeah.
Yeah, no, he really gets flensed.
Mm, yeah, it's gnarly.
Hmm. Yeah, there are bones happening there. Our heroic trio escape by boat as the castle sort of falls apart around them, and then the witches turn back up and they want to take the cauldron back, and they sort of, they're like, the bard's like, well, you know, you need to have a bargain, and they reluctantly kind of offer the sword back up, but Taran says, oh, I'm not a warrior, I'm a pig boy. And he says, I have no use for the sword, but he would trade the cauldron for Gergi returning. And then my final note is, Gergi's alive and he's enforcing heteronormativity.
He makes
Taran and Alwamwi kiss.
I do particularly like with the witches, because they're just like, ah, now mate, he's dead. That's not how things work. Your friend is dead. Would you like the sword?
Yeah.
And then Fleetiflum is just like, ah, see, I knew you weren't real witches. And they're like, right, no, I'm not taking that from you. And it's just like, yeah, just the laws of metaphysics broken by peer pressure.
And then we get a very nondescript credit sequence. I noticed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Disney tend to, you could tell that all was not right at the House of Mouse, because Disney tend to really go all in, especially, you know, 70s onwards, right? Their credit sequences tend to have all the characters you know and love and little, you know, little things in the margins, and there really isn't much of that in this one.
Nope.
No.
And I do particularly like, because there's a few, like, right at the start, when we're sort of getting Taran's character, like, established, he's sort of fantasizing about the king of the country being like, oh, you're such a hero, his sword. Look at you go, warrior. And, like, a few times he sort of imagined this king, but at the end, there isn't any sort of, oh, cheers for saving the world. It's just, the film just ends, and I kind of like the idea that backs up, that just there is no one else. there's just Taran, this weird old man that he lives with, that's like, go hide in the woods with a pig, no, I won't give you snacks or water as you found.
Yeah.
and some fairies, and that's it.
Yeah, it's a weirdly empty film. It's like,
and they do get reunited with the pig.
Yeah.
Mm.
But it's like the whole society, like, is just living within the castle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it's post-apocalyptic.
I mean, they might just be in mid Wales. It's pretty sparsely populated. If it turns out they're just at, like, I don't know, Dolgellau. It's because there's no one here.
But yeah, it's definitely a curio, but I didn't hate it.
No. The background art is lovely, and that really sustained me.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, yeah, it's a really, really, yeah, good backgrounds and animation.
I feel like both of us were just watching this going like, oh, that's nice moss. Oh, look at that moss.
Yeah.
And like the art direction of it is really interesting, because like sort of the opening scene going in, like all the trees, looking through the trees at this like, kind of Iron Age inspired medieval thatched house situation, and like the trees are old and like all gnarly, like everything's it's not that usual sort of, there's nothing's cute.
No I mean, that's you can tell it's from the same period as Fox and the Hound, because that has that sort of odd disjunction between the really cutesy character designs and then the kind of oddly kind of craggy naturalistic background art. And there's a similar thing going on here.
And I wonder if that's partly just like, I'm wondering if someone from the studio like came to Britain and like went to, I don't know, like the New Forest or the Savernake Forest or something, and saw like really old oak trees and were like, I want to draw these forever. And there's just a few Disney films where it's like, yeah, he was just really into them trees.
Yeah, but I like it does look quite dismal at times, which is interesting, because there aren't many. Like, a lot of old Disney films do spooky and creepy. Like, if you think of, like, the woods in early Disney films, like Pinocchio or Snow White. But these trees aren't like those trees. Like, these aren't spooky trees, they're dismal trees.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, and I bet, you know, it'd be interesting. I imagine there are some people out there and this is their favourite ever Disney film. Like, I can totally see, like, how, like, Matty, you know, you enjoyed it as a kid, and I can totally see how some kids could really imprint onto this film. I suspect I would have liked it quite a lot, actually, if I'd watched it at the right age. Because, like, I don't know, my love of Narnia and things like that.
Mm.
I suspect if I'd watched this when I was sort of 11, 12, I probably would have enjoyed it quite a lot, actually.
Yeah. And you can absolutely imagine it being of its age peers as a Disney film. Like, the film that would get people or kids to be like, I want to be an animator.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah. I want to do that. Yeah. That looks amazing. That king is terrifying. I want to know how to do that. And it is a credit to the people that worked on it, because, like, there was some... Right at the end, when they're making their escape, there's some, like, weird wibbly-wobbly towers that appear to have no purpose whatsoever. They're like, spiked towers that, like, fall over onto them. And I'm pretty sure that's stop motion animation.
Really? I'll have to...
And there's...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and, like, there's no context for why they're there. They're just there to make for a dangerous workplace, presumably. But there's just loads of stuff like that, where, like, watching as a child, like, and being able to be, like, almost, like, selective about what you care about, it just looks awesome. And the plot makes... It makes sense, but not in, like, a satisfying way.
Yeah, yeah, it doesn't...
Art direction by Don Griffith, uncredited.
Oh.
Seems a bit rude.
I think he might have left the company.
Oh.
There was okay. A lot of people in and out, so I don't know if it's that he left or something.
All right, yeah. Yeah, there's quite a lot.
I mean,
of
there are definitely times where I thought this looked like a Don Bluth film.
Yeah.
To be honest, like...
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. It did make me think of... I might be about to show my ass.
Well, there's a little bit of Secret.
Old Doctor to Heaven.
Yeah, a bit of Secret of Nim to it, I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any notes that haven't been... Any more thoughts, Matty?
The voice actor for Ilonwy, yeah. Susan Sheridan, noddy.
Noddy?
Noddy. I thought you'd make that face. I'm glad I took that note.
Oh, wow.
And apparently a trillion in the Hitchhiker's Guide original radio series.
I knew I recognised that voice. Never. Oh, that's great. And the narrator at the start and the end is John Huston.
Yeah.
So this is another, like, weird connection. So he was the voice of Gandalf in, like, the weird 1977 animation.
Oh, also, Angelica... The Ralph one?
No, there was another one. Not the Basque one. There was another one. And he's also Angelica Huston's dad, Morticia Adams. So it's just like,
And the witches.
And the witches. It's just like, oh, more connections to your podcast. I mean, Noddy's not a connection, but, you know.
Noddy is horrifying, though, so, you know.
Just do an episode about how Noddy can just not.
There's definitely a cursed, troubling current 93 album about Noddy, I remember. Yeah, I could definitely put some of that. We could do a Noddy episode. I'm pretty sure Noddy freaked me out as a kid.
It was actually genuinely quite scary. Noddy,
yeah, wasn't.
I think I had Noddy on a video with Green Claws, possibly. So do you remember Green Claws? Look up Green Claws. If you're listening to this podcast, look up Green Claws. He's a real gentle soul. He's got a sort of gentle Scottish accent. But he looks like the Michelin man has fallen in a swamp and got crossed a swamp thing.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. That's a situation. That is a situation. I am unsure how I feel about that.
It's on YouTube if you want to give it a watch.
Excellent. That's yeah.
I don't know what we're doing next, but I'm sure we'll get another episode in before Christmas.
No. Yeah, and if this does come out like before Halloween, or on Halloween, that would be our 7th anniversary.
We're so old.
The consistency is
astounding. Yeah, something no one has ever said about this podcast before. Thanks.
You exist. What more could anyone want?
Right. On, that's a high point, right. I think, that praise. So let's run the credits.
Intro is by Maki Yamazaki. Outro is by Joe Kelly. Artwork's by Letty Wilson. I'll put their details in the show notes. You can email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com and find us on Instagram at stillscaredpodcast. Thank you, Matty, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was great to be here.
Do you have a sign off for us?
Yeah, I hope, Creepy Kids, that you managed to remain as consistent as we are.
Yeah. Can it only dream?
Bye.
See you next time, Creepy Kids.
Just keep existing.
Bye.